crush your enemies.
They drew first blood, not me.
See them driven before you?
Oh, my user.
And they hear the lamentation of their women.
But I pity the fool.
Glitter in the dark near the Ten House Gate.
Phone home.
They're here.
Oh, real light sleeper, child.
Welcome to Vintage Video, where we're rewatching the 80s so you don't have to. We'll be reviewing every major film release of the 1980s in chronological order, overanalyzing what you've seen and spoiling what you haven't. I'm Patrick O'Reilly.
I'm Jesse Bayless.
And I'm Richard Wells.
And today we're discussing Personal Best, released February 5th, 1982. It was written and directed by Robert Towne and released by Warner Brothers. When Robert Towne struck a deal with Warner Brothers, a SAG signatory, all of the non-actor cast were required to join the Screen Actors Guild. But 1 month into production, in July of 1980, SAG famously went on strike, shutting the film down. Towne tried suing SAG, alleging some obligation to warn the athletes that a strike was coming, and signing would contractually forbid them from working on set. Warner Brothers dropped the film from their production slate during the pause, and it was picked up by the Geffen Company, allowing filming to resume. But cinematographer Ray Villalobos was no longer available and replaced with Michael Chapman, who himself was replaced again before the end of the production. Towne was quite combative with Geffen, dragging his feet signing agreements with the studio and running way over schedule for what Geffen considered to be simple scenes. These disagreements culminated in Geffen removing the editorial crew from their offices and padlocking the edit bays until Towne agreed to a reduced profit participation as penance for going over budget and schedule. Instead, Towne signed contracts with distributor Warner Brothers for the rights to future projects Greystoke and Tequila Sunrise in exchange for a $1 million paycheck, put in escrow as collateral against any further overages on Personal Best. Towne's suit against SAG was thrown out when the strike was resolved. Originally, Towne envisioned a fully non-actor cast because the performances he wanted from the story would come more naturally to them, though he did approach Jack Nicholson to play Coach Tingloff, the role that eventually went to Scott Glenn.
I'm so confused about how they were keeping him on track here. So he goes over budget.
Right.
And Geffen, who picked up the film after Warner Brothers dropped it,
yeah,
said, no more of that. You're going to make less on the back end. And he wouldn't sign that. And so what does Warner Brothers have anything to do with this?
Warner's distributing still.
Okay, so Warner's still distributing.
So they gave him $1 million to buy the distribution rights to hit two other projects that he was currently working on. And he told Geffen that he had this $1 million set aside and that if they went into any more overages that he would pay the money back to avoid signing the contract that would reduce his profit participation.
Okay.
Doesn't really matter because the movie didn't make any money.
Well, I was going to say, like,
there was no profit to participate
in. I don't understand why anybody wanted to pick up this movie in the first place.
Yeah.
Like, it's a very strange, like, it feels like a very niche kind of movie.
I think that at this time in film history, people gave a shit about running. Like, they really cared about running.
There was something about Chariots of Fire that people liked.
And Gallipoli.
And I don't understand what it is.
I don't either. I don't know what it was that people are like, oh, yeah, we can move really fast on our leg parts. But they're fascinated by it.
But what if we, like, double down? Like, they not just run, but they also jump, and they also throw rocks.
What if we show people going fast, slowly? It's fascinating.
So they're going normal speed?
Right, yeah. They're going the speed I would run at because they're Olympic-level athletes running in slow motion. Mariel Hemingway spent 9 months training so she wouldn't appear wildly incapable in comparison to her fellow athletes. Real-life Olympic coach Bill Bowerman had been consulted on set but asked for his name to be removed after seeing the film, offended by the childish characterization of Scott Glenn's Coach Terry Tingloff character. Critical reviews were middling, with the exception of Siskel and Ebert, who ranked it among their top 10 for the year.
Oh my gosh.
On a reported budget of $16
million,
it made back less than $5 million in a 10-week theatrical run.
What on earth cost $16 million?
I don't know. Every single set is the same high school track.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't tell the difference between any of these locations.
I could have made this movie for $1 million.
Well,
I would have saved $1 million in my back pocket the whole time.
Star power you were paying. Like, what? Where the hell did this money go?
I don't know where it went. I think it was just coke. It went to coke. It was spent on coke for Robert Towne.
The coke budget was just enormous.
Yeah, the Coke brothers were on set every day.
That's what he calls his drug dealers.
Yeah. And they are the actual Koch brothers, but they're rich because Robert Towne paid them $16 million for Coke.
And this is just raw coal.
We start with an obnoxiously silent opening credit sequence of just plain white text over black.
Oh my God. I was like, I was turning up the volume so loud. Yeah. It's just like, am I
There's here? Really nothing here?
There's nothing.
Not we say the name of a composer and there's not an opening theme playing?
Like, or just have like people running, the sounds of people running or
breathing.
Like the different coaching, like just the whole, just record a track.
So that I don't turn into an ape. I don't want to, like, this is William Hurt territory. I'm just slowly de-evolving. You're going to turn into a Goomba if you don't put some music in this part. We're literally 2 minutes into the film before the first sound. An applauding crowd and an echoey announcer voice at Hayward Field, Eugene, Oregon, 1976. Famously expensive track to record at. These are the Olympic trials going on. We see droplets of sweat splattering on the track, and the camera tilts up to the dripping face of Mariel Hemingway as Chris Cahill, about to pounce off the line for a qualifying round. A starter pistol sets her running. She doesn't do great in her first race, and her father is disappointed, chewing her out under the bleachers. And maybe hitting her, I don't know. We cut away, then we come back, and she's crying. But even he's not as disappointed as Scott Glenn, playing another coach, Terry Tingloff.
What the fuck do you think you're doing?
He's shouting at one of his athletes, Tori Skinner, to get into position for her shot put tryout. Tori scores big with her throw, and she turns back to her coach Terry to pantomime a jerk-off gesture at him. Really annoying that these two are named Tori and Terry.
Yeah.
And they're the second and third leads of the film.
And they aren't based on real people.
No.
These aren't real people, so there was no...
Tori basically is a real person. She's almost playing herself because she competed in these actual events.
Well, okay, but this isn't...
It's not based on a true story, no.
Yeah, this isn't autobiographical or anything like that, so why? Why do we choose these names?
I don't know.
That's so annoying.
Another gunshot sparks a dash for Tori, and she does well. Terry asks Tori how her knee is doing, and it seems fully recovered. Tori and the rest of the track athletes meet for dinner that night. Chris's father approaches their table to congratulate their performances and introduce his daughter. Chris squirms away from the table, and her father awkwardly follows her away. A few minutes later, the athletes hear a loud noise and realize that not only has Chris's father basically abandoned her here, but he's been starving her all day, and she's on the verge of passing out.
You know what's worse about the names? Sorry. I'm still hung up on it.
No, let's keep going.
Like, not just are they very similar names, they're both like androgynous names.
Right,
Terry
yeah.
and Tori could both be mm-hmm. used for both genders.
Yeah.
And so I cannot keep them
But at
straight.
Least Chris, oh, fuck. Yeah. They get her some water and Tori offers her a ride home. In the passenger seat, Chris thanks Tori and then starts sobbing over her loss. And we hard cut to the girls sharing a joint at Tori's place and cracking up together. In the course of their conversation, we learn, joking or not, that Tori dumped her boyfriend Dwayne because he doesn't have a satisfactory vertical leap. Tori asks how Indian Chris is, the first of a handful of references to the character's seemingly irrelevant Native American heritage. Chris offers a finger to Tori, and when she pulls it, Chris lets out a small fart. Like, embarrassingly small. Like, this is a terrible fart. When they start talking about the competition today, Tori claims that Chris lost her step when she noticed another competitor, Laura, but Chris flatly denies it.
I'll bet your father's always saying you don't have any killer instinct. Am I right? I thought so.
Well, listen, I'll tell you one thing. I'm as competitive as you are.
She challenges Tori to an arm wrestling contest.
Which arm? You have two choices.
When she realizes Chris is serious, the two line up to arm wrestle. They seem evenly matched at the start, but after a while, it seems like Tori is tiring out and surprised by Chris's endurance and determination. Tori is losing her composure, but Chris is a rock, and when we see her face, it looks like she's about to burst every possible blood vessel in her face simultaneously. Tori is worried about injuring herself and suggests they call it a tie, but when they count down from three, she throws Chris's arm into the carpet because she's a dirty cheater. Tori tries to explain to Chris why she sees so much potential in the young runner, but she panics when her emotions get ahead of her.
Oh, fuck. What's wrong? I'm very fucking scared right now. Very scared.
Why?
Tori leans in to kiss Chris. We jump forward in time to the two of them fully nude together. Chris is trying to tickle Tori and claims her father and brothers used to pay her to tickle them. She notices a nasty scar around Tori's kneecap from an earlier injury and surgery. Tori takes over tickling duty for a moment before they're back to making out. We jump forward again to the girls living together and bringing in groceries one afternoon. They go for a jog on the beach.
You know which beach this is, though.
Point Dune in...
It's Morro Bay.
Oh, okay.
Because this is all like shot up in the San Luis Obispo area.
Right,
like,
right.
They're at the Cal Poly track and stuff.
Yeah. On the way, Tori says she can get Tingloff to take Chris on as an athlete. We cut back to Chris's family home as she breaks it to her father that she's thinking of trading him for a new coach. Dad wants to know what kind of crazy deal this man has offered her, and Chris says he offered nothing. We cut to another practice field and slow motion footage of runners and shot putters. We see Tori making the case for Chris to Terry, but he doesn't seem to care. He eventually agrees to allow her to work out with the team, but for now he still refuses to coach her. That night, she sees Terry and Tori playfully wrestling on the field and seems jealous of the interaction. Sometime later, a practice is wrapping up and Terry calls to Chris. Of course, she thinks she's getting promoted to an actual tryout, but he just needs her to collect equipment, and Tori points out what a dick move that was, so he changes his tune.
Chris, why don't you take that open lane?
Me?
Yes, you.
Which open lane?
Any open lane, goddammit.
When the trial begins, she hasn't fully hammered in her starting blocks, and she falls right at the firing of the starter pistol.
My God, she fainted.
But the story of this trial is that she gets back on her feet and finishes third, even in such a short race. Terry approaches her afterward, and she explains about the starting block. She doesn't realize yet that her recovery was impressive enough to make a point that training her isn't a complete waste of time. We get a training montage of Chris mixing in with the athletes. In the showers later, Chris learns that Terry is officially taking her on. We jump to the Cali Columbia World Student Games in 1978. The athletes are all given a quick lesson on the perils of the region, including the dreaded Montezuma's Revenge, but they are bored and zoning in and out of these speeches. The next day, in an open-air market, we see Chris buying fruits from a street vendor. As her fellow athletes warn her against the purchase, she assures them that fruit is not water, ignoring the fact that fruits are mostly water.
Well, and they're washed and touched by hands. And.
But she assumes the skin of a fruit is impermeable to bacteria. We jump right to that night in their communal bathroom where she suffers from severe abdominal distress. The other athletes bring a medical student in the absence of a doctor, and he offers Chris a puff of opium to ease her intestinal cramps.
I was so sure this was going to lead to some sort of like disqualification, but nothing ever comes of it.
Nope. Sometime later, Tori is cuddled with Chris on the bathroom floor and she seems to be doing better, but when Tori tries to leave, Chris begs her to stay here on the floor and she does. Tori is a wreck the next day, but Terry blames her own stupidity and forces her to finish her events either way, regardless of how her subpar performances will affect her overall rating as an athlete. Chris tries to accept the blame, but Terry doesn't give a shit. In contrast with Terry, Chris is actually having a much better day.
You gotta get food poisoning more often.
Thank you and fuck you.
What's that mean?
Chris is upset with how Terry treats Tori and credits Tori with inspiring her success. We cut to a hotel party that night, and we open the scene with a close-up of toe socks with toes wiggling to music. Very uncomfortable. One of the athletes at the party sings a song about steroids.
We're healthy young athletes, the world's strongest I've heard. When we take those pills, our strength becomes absurd. Oh, why must there be Dianabol at all?
Tori arrives to the party and Terry corners her immediately. We can't hear what he says, but she offers to go get Chris and tells her it's bedtime. Apparently, this isn't what Terry asked her to do, and he drags her out of the party where she apologizes. Sometime later, Terry drives up to find Chris doing stretches in the shade of a row of trees and asks about her Native American heritage again. She gets a bad cramp and he moves to support her and massage it out. He makes a deal with her. If she spends the summer here training with him, he's prepared to offer her a full ride next year.
Room, board, tuition, everything.
She agrees right away, but when Terry suggests she train as a pentathlete, she hesitates because that's Tori's event. He assures her that even if Tori represents the U.S. in a pentathlon, there's still room for two more athletes. It's a three-person team. Chris still isn't sold on the idea.
I don't know what scares you more. Getting beat by Tori Skinner or beating her?
That night, Tori seems a bit standoffish, and Chris assumes that she's upset about the pentathlon training and offers to drop out because she doesn't care about this event in the first place. Tori claims not to mind. So much of this is reminding me of The Competition.
Oh, yeah,
because
for sure.
The whole point of the movie is, can you compete at your peak performance against someone who you're in love with, basically.
Yeah.
But I think that movie does all of the parts of this better than this movie does. And none of the characters have names that are one vowel off of from each other.
Well, and I care about as little about piano playing as I do about running, and I actually enjoyed that one better.
We cut to the girls running in slow motion along the beach again. We hear a synthy score and the heavy breathing of the runners, and I was simultaneously reminded of Chariots of Fire and 2001 A Space Odyssey. That scene where he's floating through space. Is there breathing over the Stargate sequence, or is it just after that?
The Stargate sequence?
Yeah, at the end of 2001.
Oh, no, yeah. It's just you just hear the sounds of that. But the whole time that he's like in the suits or they're...
At the top of a sand dune, they find Terry sunbathing beside a boombox and wordlessly gesturing for them to run back down the dune. It's clear they hadn't decided what would be playing on these speakers because Terry is slapping his thigh and bouncing his foot to a beat, but the broadcast is just some sports announcer. We watch Chris begin training for pentathlon, scored with another short synthy beat that sounds like it came from an exercise video. We see a long montage of crotch close-ups as people jump back over the high bar. Terry puts a piece of tape in the grass for Chris to use as a reference for her jumping off point. Later, we see Chris finding her name in an article about the best high jump competitors, and she's excited to be listed among them. Tori seems to be making minor adjustments to Chris's scheduled workouts, and it's pissing Terry off. When they're apart, he warns Chris that the upcoming Pan Am Games only offer 2 athlete slots, and implies that Tori might be shifting her out of contention to secure her own spot. Later, we see Terry running Chris and a male athlete around the Cal Poly track, and he heckles the leading male runner until Chris eventually passes him.
Uh-oh, too bad! You just let a pussy beat you, you dumb asshole!
Chris and Tori have a short argument in the car when Chris says she's going to have Tingloff spot her in the gym from now on because there's better squatting equipment in the men's gym. It's clear Tori feels them pulling apart, but Chris is very dismissive of the sanctity of their partnership.
Jesus Christ, Tori, we're friends.
Yeah, we may be friends, but every once in a while we also fuck each other.
She tells Chris they can't live together anymore. Chris promises to continue training with Tori and not Terry because she needs Tori in her life.
Okay. I guess I can't argue with that.
That night in bed together, Tori kicks off her foreplay with another round of tickling. The next morning, the track is dense with fog. Tori is being a grump and eventually admits that it's because she has some high jump advice, but she knows Terry Tingloff will give her shit for the slightest adjustment to Chris's form. Chris drags the tip out of Tori, and it amounts to taking bigger steps during her approach. She says they're differently skilled runners and moves Chris's marker tape in the dirt to a more efficient jumping off point. Unfortunately, when she looks up to speak with Chris, she steps on the tape again and repositions it even further out. The camera work is very careful to mask whether or not this was a deliberate adjustment. On her next attempt, the jump is too far for Chris, and she dislocates her knee in the final step. It's a disgusting injury because her knee is all tweaked apart and lumpy in her pant leg, and the assistant coach has to pop it back in place before they treat it with ice. Terry comes over to see what happened, and Tori admits to moving the mark. Obviously, Terry's pissed and levels a subtle accusation.
I hope you understand all this.
Tori asks Chris if she honestly believes this was intentional sabotage, and Chris won't answer. Later in the sauna, Tori enters without Chris, and the girls ask how she's doing, but Tori tells them all to shut up. We see Terry and Chris share a tender moment at the hospital. She spends the rest of her recovery living in his home, where he treats her to some of his impressive ice cream collection.
What flavor?
Chocolate, vanilla, coffee, rum raisin.
No strawberry?
Strawberry too.
Chris sits and watches Laverne and Shirley while Terry prepares some ice cream and the phone keeps ringing. He won't let her answer because he's sure it's Tori and they shouldn't be talking. She tries to answer anyway, so he takes the whole thing and hurls it across the room.
All you're worried about is your fucking girlfriend.
Now he fills her in on a bit of his backstory. He had a shot at coaching a men's team, but he passed on it for this opportunity. Chris assures Terry that Tori did not mean to injure her, and Terry launches into a joke about a serviceman throwing a gay man out of the Empire State Building.
Marine gets down to the street. He passes the f*** in the gutter. F*** gets up on one elbow and says, "Yoo-hoo, I'm not mad."
Bizarrely, that's the whole joke. I don't even understand the point of this.
Yeah.
The lesson here. Terry gets up in her face and demands she punch him and is somehow surprised when she follows through.
It'd be nice to see you cut the balls.
Oh, God. Oh, shit.
Why do you always have to do what I tell you?
He joins her in the bed and they hug, but the hugging turns into more until he bumps her injury and they pause for a second. Sometime later, we see Terry dropping her off back at her old place with Tori. Chris has a cast now and crutches, but she's just here to move out the last of her stuff. Later still, we see Chris doing some physical therapy in a big pool, and she distracts a training swimmer we will come to know as Denny, who bonks his head on the side of the pool watching her. In the gym afterward, they offer to spot each other, and Denny is clearly impressed with Chris's strength here. Denny tries to warm up with the same set of free weights Chris was just bouncing like nothing, and for added pressure, she's standing with her thighs touching both sides of his face as she spots him, and he stares mesmerized into her crotch.
Is this how that works? I mean, I've never lifted weights, but I feel like...
This is how me and Mariel have always done it.
I feel like, as a spotter, you wouldn't literally have your crotch, like, directly over their right. face.
I mean, to each their own. She gives him notes on his form, and he can't quite match her reps, nearly dropping the bar before she grabs it. At the next practice, Chris is ready to try all of her events. Terry proposes keeping Tori and Chris separate on the field, and Chris refuses to train if she can't train with everyone. Walking away, she spots the water polo team and her new friend, Denny. All the men are chugging beers in the pool before a friendly match. After the game, we see Chris and Denny out to lunch. He tells the story of the year he won 2 gold medals at the Olympics, but he admits the ceremony was anticlimactic. After lunch, he drives her home and walks her to her door. She lets him walk all the way back to the car before making any kind of move to keep him here.
If you're not in a hurry, slow down.
Suddenly, they're at his place together. He's naked in bed, and she brings him snacks while he watches TV. He asks why she was so secretive about her own place, and asks what about her roommate she needs to keep secret from him.
2 greatest looking girls in San Luis Obispo. Wasn't a secret.
Yeah, well, what do you think about that?
I think we both like great looking girls. Don't. I don't care.
She seems relieved that it doesn't bother him. He rises from bed to pee, and she excitedly offers to hold his penis while he relieves himself because it's something she's always wanted to do. He lets her do it, and we cut away to the U.S. Olympic trials. As the tryouts are setting up, Terry makes the first mention I heard to the U.S. boycott of the 1980 games. We overhear a phone call between Chris and her parents, and her father admits that switching to Coach Tingeloff was obviously the right choice, and they couldn't be prouder of her. In a cafeteria, Chris and Terry pass Tori, and Chris tries to say hi but gets no response, and Terry pulls her away. He forbids her from talking to Tori, but she steps away from her own meal anyway to wish Tori luck tomorrow. The next day, at the Olympic pentathlon tryouts, we see a run where Tori takes second place, but Chris clips a hurdle and finishes 5th. Shot put is about the same, but when it comes to high jump, Chris starts catching back up in the pack. Someone alerts her that her brother is here to see her, but when she's escorted to the stands, Denny is here. He gives her a couple tips, and she assumes they were fed to him by Terry. Chris exceeds her own high jump record by 3 inches. Rain is pouring down on the trials now as the athletes head into the long jump event. Tori's distance suffers from the wet track as she slips to 4th place in the rankings.
I feel like that's not fair.
Yeah, I agree.
That you make them run on... Like, I know that they tried to brush the water off, but like...
Yeah.
Like,
it seems like a health hazard even.
If it was an official Olympic event and it was raining, would they just continue with the event?
Yeah, that's crazy.
And I feel like in other sports where everybody, like, where everybody's playing on the same field at the same time, like, yeah, okay, go on when it's raining because it's an equal playing field. You're all right there at the same time. But if somebody ran on dry and now somebody's running on wet,
yeah, it's not fair.
Yeah, especially for qualifying.
Yeah.
Chris goes to check on Tori in the medical tent, and one of the physicians tells Chris that Tori is skipping the 5th event because of her minor injury in the long jump. Chris thinks that's a bullshit excuse and hassles Tori for it.
You can run. Oh, yeah? You know how hurt I am? I know exactly how hurt you are.
Chris bullies Tori into the last race, and in the end, Tori places 1st in the event, and Cahill crosses through 4th. Meaning that the final Olympic pentathlon team will have Tori and Chris together, or it would, but we close with the historical disclaimer from the announcers that, as we mentioned before, this team won't actually be going to the Olympics.
That the U.S. Olympic team consists of Pooch Anderson, Chris Cahill, and Tori Skinner. And with the boycott at Moscow, they are all dressed up with nowhere to go.
What the hell?
Yeah.
Like, seriously, Why did we watch this whole movie?
This whole movie is about people qualifying for an Olympics
nothing.
That we were boycotting.
I was
so it mattered so little.
I was so annoyed at the end of this. I'm like, what was the point of any of this?
Well, you could still here's the thing though. You can still compete under the Olympic flag. I mean, that's what a lot of countries do that are forbidden to play. Like like Russia is still in the Olympics even though they're not allowed to send competitors. They just they just can't use the Russian flag and they can't compete for the country of Russia.
Well, do you have a flag?
Wait, I don't understand. That's different than the fact that they're boycotting the games, right?
Well, yeah. So it's like, so America isn't going to have a U.S. Olympic team, but you as an athlete can still go and compete.
But represent who?
You represent yourself.
Can an individual just say, I'm going to compete in the Olympics, not representing any country?
If you've qualified, yes.
If you've qualified, according to who?
But like, well,
the Olympic Committee.
Okay, that makes sense to me because there's qualification standards, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, you have to place this far up in all of these different meets in order to be considered qualified.
I think we should see more of that then. I think more people should just be applying to the Olympics without.
Well, but I think what happens is if you're in the running. You want to be on the team because they're going to pay for you to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, they're going to make sure that your room and board is covered. They're going to pay a coach. They're going to take care of everything for you. And so you want to be on the team. And if you're close to being on the team, you want to be on the team.
Yeah. Interesting. Chris hugs and kisses Denny on the sidelines. And as they take their places on the podium, Tori admits that he's cute for a guy. The end. That's the whole movie.
What's the point of this movie?
I don't know. Why did Robert Towne write and direct this? He wrote Chinatown, which is like his big ticket item on his filmography. Why did he think a lesbian love triangle was something that he should be talking to people about? Why did he think running was interesting?
But what are they even, like, even if the point of this movie is something to do with this, you know, love triangle or whatever, I don't even understand what's happening. Like, what is the arc of the story by the end? Because now there's this other guy that gets introduced right towards the end of the film.
Yeah, that's her new boyfriend. Mm-hmm.
And what are we saying about any of this?
Yeah, I don't know what the message is. And I don't know why he felt like this was his story to tell. It's just a weird choice.
I'm not sure what's compelling about it. Like, I don't think that anybody really transforms in any way.
No. And it's a very horny movie. Like,
is it? I felt it was.
Like,
I felt like, I mean, there's a lot of nudity. It goes unmentioned because it's not important to the plot.
Yeah.
But most of it is asexual nudity, where it's literally just biology, people in saunas and stuff.
I say this got more seduction than The Seduction.
No. Definitely not. There's like a hot lady naked playing with her boobs for like a third of that movie. But this movie, whenever someone's naked, it's like they're cleaning themselves or relieving themselves.
Yeah.
It's like it's not sexy nudity.
Agree to disagree.
All right.
Richard just really likes it when people run.
Yeah, there you go. No, I was really surprised that I was like, oh, we're getting full frontal male too. It's like, okay, great.
Yeah.
This has got something
okay,
for everybody.
Great.
Something for everybody.
I don't think anybody wants that.
did it bother either of you that they compete in a lot of these events with so much jewelry on? Like, especially, like, they're throwing the shot.
I did not notice.
They're throwing shot put with rings on their fingers. And that seems like it would hurt.
I don't know. So. Didn't.
I mean, they're all actual shot putters mostly.
Yeah,
so I would guess that's how they actually do it.
And I looked it up. I mean, there's plenty of athletes in the Olympics who wear jewelry.
Yeah.
It just seems like if you're training.
Yeah.
I would just want to just be unrestricted, I guess would be the word.
Yeah, it should be like the ancient Greek way. I see what you're saying. Fully nude.
Well,
for every event.
Well, it just seems like, you know, you're doing things like. Like a necklace or earrings is one thing, but like something that's on your fingers, like where you're using a lot of your motion and you might get swelling from exerting yourself. And then like you have a ring on your finger that your hands are swollen on.
What if you go to throw the shot put and your ring catches on your necklace and you accidentally throw your whole head out into the stands?
So it didn't bother.
No, it didn't bother me. It still doesn't bother me because I don't think that shot put, like I would get it if you're like doing some sort of event where you're your grip is important, where you're literally like
I think it's important to shot put.
No, because I think it's resting in your hand, and then I think you're propelling it with like the arm motion and the centrifugal force and it's not about it's not like you're throwing a baseball here. It's not about your fingers.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know anything about shot put.
Well, anyway. I don't either. It just seemed odd, like yeah. that they were wearing so much jewelry.
Yeah.
In training.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the whole film. That's everything there is to it. I'm gonna call this a thumbs down. I don't think this is necessary.
Yeah,
it's a thumbs down. I didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think what should have happened with the boycott. The boycott information should have come at the very end. That should be like the sad note that it leaves you on. Not like you like where it drops the drops them out from under you. Like they're all happy that they got into the team.
Right.
And then they find out and it's just like, oh God. Then you'd be really upset.
Yeah, but I it's probably not realistic.
Mm.
But I found out at the end because I didn't know that we boycotted the whatever 1980 Olympics.
Well, that wasn't the story wasn't written that way. They had to add those two references to the script.
Oh, toward the end of production. Happened.
Because it was like the movie was shooting in 1980.
Yeah.
And so it's supposed to be about these girls qualifying for the actual Olympics. And then when it didn't happen, it was like, now they're qualifying for an Olympics that isn't even happening. It's like, ooh, that's a cool idea to take the stakes down like 99% in the last 3 seconds of the movie.
Yeah.
All right, Jess, where's this going on your letterbox?
It's actually at the bottom of my list.
Is it?
I was like, oh, no, it's this one. I enjoyed all of the other films more than this because this one is so boring.
Yeah.
Nothing happened and there's no point. So it's 14 out of 14 for the season. I don't really have anything good to say, but it took me so long to get through this movie.
The notes were really hard.
It's 2 hours and some minutes.
Oh my
long.
God, yeah, that didn't need to happen either.
No, not at all. I think it took me 4 sit downs to like watch this whole film, and every section that I watched was exactly the same as
there's,
the last.
There's 6 scenes in this movie, but 4 of them play 8 times each.
Yeah, well, and also there's all the slow motion.
Right, yeah.
And all those gratuitous crotch shots going over the high jump.
Yeah, it's funny that felt gratuitous to me, but all the sauna stuff didn't. But we're actually seeing all the vaginas. Anyway, Richard, what do you have letterboxed?
I have it at 13 out of 14. Puts it below Island of Blood, but above Mad Men.
I also have it at 13 out of 14, which is below Mad Men, but just above Night Crossing. Night Crossing is still the bottom of my list.
At least Night Crossing, they made a cool balloon.
Yeah, that'd be cool if at the end they were like, oh, but it turns out that it doesn't matter. Go back. Like they did at the end of this movie.
Yeah.
Our writer-director here was Robert Towne. Before this, he had worked primarily as a screenwriter and script doctor on titles like Bonnie and Clyde, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and most famously Chinatown. He wrote uncredited on Orca and Heaven Can Wait. So far on the show, he's written The Last Detail. After Personal Best, he writes Greystoke Legend of Tarzan, Tough Guys Don't Dance, Tequila Sunrise, which he also directed, The Firm, and Mission Impossible's 1 and 2. This was his first directing credit. The music here came from Jill Frazier. This was her first composing credit, and later she scores Reckless and Cutting Class. More music came from Jack Nitzsche. He earlier scored One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Hardcore. Previously on the show, he's composed the scores for Cruising, Heartbeat, and Cutter's Way. And later he scores Officer and a Gentleman, The Razor's Edge, Starman, Stand By Me, and Mermaids. He won an Oscar for Best Original Song for composing Up Where We Belong for An Officer and a Gentleman. Cinematographer here was Michael Chapman for most of the film. He's the credited cinematographer, but like I said, there were 2 uncredited cinematographers. Chapman's first credit was for The Last Detail, in which he also played a taxi driver, and then he came back to light Scorsese's Taxi Driver. He has credits on the 78 Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Hardcore, The Wanderers. So far on the show, he's lit Raging Bull, and later he lights Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, The Man with 2 Brains, The Lost Boys, Scrooged, Ghostbusters 2, Quick Change, Kindergarten Cop, Doc Hollywood, and Space Jam. You see he connected with Ivan Reitman there.
Yeah, exactly.
Another cinematographer, Caleb Deschanel, also DP'd on More American Graffiti, The Black Stallion, Being There. After this, he lit The Right Stuff, The Natural, It Could Happen to You, Fly Away Home, The Patriot, Passion of the Christ, The Spiderwick Chronicles, and Killer Joe.
Mm. And he's the father of Zoe and Emily.
That's right. And we actually have one more credit in common because me and Caleb Deschanel both worked on Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
Nice.
Where he was the cinematographer and I was a rotoscope artist for the 3D post conversion. Ruining film. The third cinematographer, also uncredited, I believe, Reynaldo Villalobos. We've seen his work in Urban Cowboy and 9 to 5. Later, he lights Risky Business, Blame It on Rio, A Bronx Tale, PCU, Romeo and Michelle's High School Reunion, and Not Another Teen Movie. More recently, he has lit a handful of Breaking Bads in the first season. He had to leave this project due to the SAG strike and was unavailable when production resumed. The editor here was Jacqueline Cambus. She also cut The Gong Show Movie, Falling in Love Again, Zoot Suit. She's back later this season for Cat People and later Surf 2, Money Pit, My Stepmother's an Alien, Mermaids, Made in America, Milk Money, so a lot of Richard Benjamin stuff. She also cut School Ties and Freddy Got Fingered. Another editor credit for Jerry Huggins, who also cut Cat People, and Ned Humphreys, who is the husband of fellow editor Jacqueline Cambus. He also cut Never Too Young to Die, that John Stamos, Gene Simmons ridiculous movie we are always on the verge of watching. Another editor credit for Walt Mulconery, who also cut Flashdance and The Karate Kid, and a final editing credit for Bud S. Smith, who also cut Sorcerer, and so far on the show Cruising and Falling in Love Again. Later he cuts Flashdance, Karate Kid, Poltergeist 2, and Darkman. Mariel Hemingway played Chris Cahill before this she'd appeared in something called Lipstick, and then her Oscar-nominated role as the 42-year-old Woody Allen's 17-year-old girlfriend in Manhattan. She was eager to prove herself as a legitimate actress and fought hard for this role despite Towne's intent to cast the film entirely from professional athletes. Mariel did have some athletic experience and worked with trainers to keep up with the rest of the cast, gaining 17 pounds of muscle and 1.5 inches of height in the process, because she actually built up her muscle enough that it stretched her body out. After this, we'll see her again next season, portraying the ill-fated Dorothy Stratton in Bob Fosse's Star 80. Later credits include Superman 4, Tequila Sunset, Naked Gun 33 and a Third as herself, and Deconstructing Harry with Woody Allen again. She's also the granddaughter of novelist Ernest Hemingway. Scott Glenn played Terry Tingeloff. He was Bart Mancuse in The Hunt for Red October. He's John Adcox in Backdraft. He's a David Carradine-style wise man character in Sucker Punch. He's Jack Crawford in Silence of the Lambs. He was in the first season of that Castle Rock Hulu Stephen King show. He's Stick in Daredevil and The Defenders. And he and Hemingway were the only two professional actors cast. Patrice Donnelly plays Tori Skinner. Obviously, she doesn't have many other credits. She did go to the 76 Olympics and was once ranked third in the world for pentathlon and fourth in hurdling. Kenny Moore played Denny Stites. He actually ran the marathon in 68 and 72 Olympics, but he's here playing a swimmer and polo player. He reunited with writer-director Towne as Woody in the cast of Tequila Sunrise in 88.
This was the first time I ever actually saw water polo being played. I don't know what I thought it was, but I didn't think it was this.
Yeah. Where are the horses?
Drowning. Jim Moody played Roscoe Travis. He was Farrell in Fame. He's Daddy Green in The Last Dragon and Arnie in DC Cab. We saw him last as Justice Hayden in First Family. Emily Dole played Maureen. She appeared in 103 episodes of the original Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling as Mountain Fiji and later showed up as Thumper in Son-in-Law. Larry Pennell played Rick Cahill. We've seen him as George in The Man with Bogart's Face. Later he's Aches in Metal Storm, The Destruction of Jared Sin. He's appeared several times as Clark Cable impersonator, but not the one we saw in Under the Rainbow last season. He was Gable in a Marilyn Monroe TV movie in 82, and later in Another Chance and an episode of Quantum Leap. He's also credited as Kemo Sabe in Bubba Hotep. Luana Anders played Rita Cahill. She's appeared in several Western films and series as a child actor, and then in The Pit and the Pendulum, Dementia 13, Easy Rider, and Going South. We'll see her next in Coppola's One from the Heart this season, and later The Two Jakes and Hearts and Souls. George de la Peña played Raul. We saw him last in the titular role of Herbert Ross's Nijinsky. Robert Patton played Colin Sayles. We saw him last as a technician in Westworld. Len Dawson played a football announcer. He was an actual NFL announcer after a successful career on the field, a first-round Steelers draft pick, and the Super Bowl IV MVP. He later played for the Browns, the Texans, and the Kansas City Chiefs. Richard Martini played Meat Manager. He was the assistant of Towne's, who later directs You Can't Hurry Love and Con Man, C-A-N-N-E-S, man. It's a movie. It's like a mockumentary about making a fake movie at the Cannes Film Festival. Michael Lapree played Track Fan. He's back this season as a gang member in Death Wish 2 and as the pizza man in E.T. the Extraterrestrial. At the very beginning of the movie, he delivers the pizza. More recently, he was uncredited as an Arkham patient in Joker. Andrew Traister played an Olympic official. His only previous credit was 15 years back in 1967 as Sergeant Magalario in Zontar, the Thing from Venus. Further non-actor cast members include pentathletes Jane Frederick and Jodie Anderson, hurdler Jane LaPlante, and shot putter Maren Seidler. I think that's everything for Personal Best. If you have any thoughts you'd like to share, you can find all our socials at linktree.com/vintagevideopod. If you enjoy what we're doing, consider giving us a review on iTunes. I don't think it helps the visibility, but it's good for our morale. And if you really like the show, maybe you should join our Patreon campaign at patreon.com/vintagevideopodcast. Speaking of, what's that sound?
We got one!
That's right, it's a new patron, Darren Merlo. As a $5 patron of the show, Darren now has access to 50 full-size 70s reviews and a hand in choosing next month's film. For May of 1973, our $5 patrons are choosing between the following 13 titles. Black Eye, Jack Arnold's neo-noir blaxploitation detective story about a black PI named simply Stone solving a series of murders involving a cane stolen from the estate of a deceased silent film star. It stars Fred Williamson as Stone, Rosemary Forsyth, Teresa Graves, and Richard Anderson. Not that Richard Anderson. The Black Windmill, Don Spiegel's British spy thriller about an agent trying to rescue his kidnapped son. It stars Michael Caine, Donald Pleasence, Delphine Seyrig, Clive Revel, and John Vernon. Chosen Survivors, Sutton Rowley's horror sci-fi film about a random group of people selected by supercomputer and flown to an underground bat-infested bomb shelter to survive an impending nuclear apocalypse. It stars Jackie Cooper, Alex Cord, Richard Jekyll, and Bradford Dillman. Daisy Miller, Peter Bogdanovich's period drama about the titular Daisy Miller being warned against socializing with people below her social status. It stars Sybil Shepherd, Barry Brown, Cloris Leachman, Mildred Natwick, and Eileen Brennan. Dirty Mary Crazy Larry, John Huff's road crime drama about a pair of amateur racers leading a high-speed chase with a female passenger in tow. It stars Peter Fonda, Susan George, Adam Rourke, and Vic Morrow. Flesh for Frankenstein, aka Andy Warhol's Frankenstein, despite Warhol's negligible involvement. Paul Morrissey's X-rated adaptation of the Mary Shelley classic. In this version, Dr. Frankenstein creates male and female monsters with the intention of mating them to produce a master race. It stars Udo Kier as Frankenstein, Joe D'Alessandro, Monique Van Vooren, and Arno Juerging. The Holy Mountain, Alejandro Jodorowsky's Technicolor Surrealism masterpiece about a wizened alchemist who leads a Jesus figure and seven planetary personifications to enlightenment. It also stars Alejandro Jodorowsky, Horatio Salinas, Luis Lomeli, and Zemira Saunders. Huckleberry Finn, J. Lee Thompson's musical adaptation of Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn with original songs from the legendary Sherman Brothers. A sequel to 73's Tom Sawyer from a lot of the same creatives, Huckleberry stars Jeff East, Paul Winfield, Harvey Korman, and David Wayne. Not that David Wayne. The Lords of Flatbush, Martin Davidson's period coming-of-age drama about four friends in a 50s Brooklyn social club stealing cars and chasing girls. It stars Perry King, Sylvester Stallone, Henry Winkler, and Paul Mace. Madhouse, Jim Clark's British horror classic about a once-beloved horror film star being released from an asylum to return to work years after his fiancée's brutal murder. Now he finds his famous character seems to be committing more murders against his will. It stars Vincent Price in the lead, Peter Cushing, of course, Robert Quarry, and Adrian Corey. The Mutations, Jack Cardiff's sci-fi horror film about an evil scientist crossbreeding his students with Venus flytraps to create a race of walking, talking plants and selling off rejects to the local freak show. Serious s vibes.
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
It stars Donald Pleasence as the scientist, Tom Baker, Brad Harris, and Julie Ege. Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, Michael Cimino's crime comedy film about a retired bank robber and his new young sidekick gathering the team for one final heist. It stars Clint Eastwood, Jeff Bridges, Jeffrey Lewis, and George Kennedy, or Zandi's Bride, Jan Troell's Western film about a cattle rancher in the American West who orders a Swedish bride by mail and gets more than he bargained for. It stars Gene Hackman, Liv Ullmann, Eileen Heckert, and Susan Tyrell for a 50th anniversary review next month. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you'll join us next time when we'll be discussing Das Boot, which IMDb describes like so. A German U-boat stalks the frigid waters of the North Atlantic as its young crew experience the sheer terror and claustrophobic life of a submariner in World War II. We leave you now with the trailer for Das Boot.